This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Carl Safina, inaugural holder of the Endowed Chair for Nature and Humanity at Stony Brook University and founding president of the not-for-profit Safina Center. Carl is the author of 7 books, including Song for the Blue Ocean, Eye of the Albatross, Voyage of the Turtle, and The View from Lazy Point. His work has been recognized with MacArthur, Pew, and Guggenheim Fellowships, and his writing has won Orion, Lannan, and National Academies Literary Awards. Carl Safina is here today to tell us about his most recent book, Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel, published in 2015. Welcome, Carl.
Thank you so much. It's really great to be here with you.
What is your purpose in writing Beyond Words?
Well, in a way, I wanted to just circle back to my original interest in life, which was, as a child, what do animals do and why do they do it? And that happens to be a very big question. It's a simple question, but it's a very big question. I'm also concerned about animals from a conservation standpoint, and we always think of them as objects or as what I call its. And we talk about their numbers. We say this species has declined by 90% and there are 3,000 of them left. But those are just numbers. And I wanted to show what their lives are like and how vivid those lives are to them and how much they want to stay alive.
Why did you choose to focus in your book on elephants, wolves, and orcas?
I focused on those because they're very, very interesting and they have structured social groups. And what I mean by that is, like, if you think of something like wildebeest or buffalo that might exist in big herds, they don't have a leader and they don't have, you know, family groups or a structure. But the ones I focused on, they do have structures. They know who their family members are. They know who their friends are. They know who their rivals are. They compete for status. Their lives follow the arc of a career. And that makes them very complicated and therefore really interesting.
How can we go about determining the degree to which animals think and feel? What are the criteria? How can we know?
There are a few ways in. One is the physical structure of the brain, its similarity to the human brain. The other is the logic of their behavior. They act frightened when it's appropriate to be frightened. They act relaxed when it's appropriate to be relaxed. They defend themselves or their mates or their territories or their babies when that's appropriate. Their lives make complete sense. So that's the logic of their behavior, as I call it. And the other is evolution and the continuum that all life is on. So we can see, for instance, that worms actually make the same chemicals that motivate behavior in worms that are the same chemicals that motivate behavior and emotion in the human brain.
What types of tests have traditionally been used to assess consciousness in animals?
Well, these words like consciousness and self-awareness and things like that, they're incredibly poorly defined in scientific literature. Different people say they mean very different things, and they've used laboratory tests. Some of them are wildly inappropriate for the actual lives that animals lead, and others have been tremendously misinterpreted. For instance, a supposed test for self-awareness is the mirror test. If an animal recognizes itself in a mirror, it is said to be self-aware. And then you say, well, what is self-awareness? Self-awareness is knowing that you are an individual different from other individuals and from your environment. But if you know that the reflection represents you, that doesn't show that you know that you're different from other individuals. Because if you didn't know you were different from other individuals, you would assume it represents you. All that test shows is that a few animals actually understand reflection. The ones that don't understand it are likely to invite the mirror image to play with them or attack the mirror image. And that shows that they are self-aware. They understand that they are separate and different from other individuals. So that test has been completely misinterpreted for all these years. It's kind of astonishing.
In your book, you speak about several qualities that were at one time considered to be uniquely human, such as tool-making, language teaching, and also the ability to imitate. To what extent do other animals possess these qualities?
To different extents. And as I say, you know, everything is on a continuum. So you can see these qualities in some other animals. You can see certain of the qualities in many other animals. And you see them in humans. You know, in the case of those things you mentioned, humans take those to an extreme in the animal kingdom. But other animals do similar kinds of things. And the other thing is we tend to assume, when we talk about humans, we tend to assume that they're all modern humans living in America, driving cars and using smartphones. But there are a lot of humans who have lived deep inside continents, surrounded by hostile tribes, with a radius of their lives no more than 10 or 15 miles for many tribes, and not really knowing what the outside world is like or what the world is like, having a few tools. Many people through the 1800s and a few people today have not had any tools more complicated than a bow and arrow. They've never made anything with moving parts. They have no machines. And yet you could take a person out of any of those tribes and teach them to play the violin. They have human minds. They're fully human people. So you can't judge other animals. You know, you can't say, well, chimpanzees only have sticks and stones and we have smartphones. That's not what makes us human. The smartphones are what humans make, and not very many people make them, and the rest of us can barely learn how to actually use them.
How do the brains of humans compare with other animals in terms of size, types of cells, and nerve pathways? Is there anything unique about the human brain?
Well, there's something unique about the human brain, and there's something unique about the elephant brain, or for that matter, the chipmunk brain. I mean, all of these things are unique. The human brain is relatively large for our size. We have lots and lots of neurons. That seems to have a lot to do with intelligence and capability. Neurons are like the processing power of a brain. We don't have the biggest brain. Elephants and whales and dolphins have bigger brains than we do. And the individual neurons in human brains are not very unusual. In fact, if you were to look at a human neuron, a mouse neuron, and a fly neuron under a microscope, you couldn't tell the difference. So a lot has to do with how many there are and how they are organized. Human brains are a lot like big chimpanzee brains, and you see all the same structures. You see most of the same structures in human brains as in every other mammal brain and most other vertebrate brains, along with the same hormones and chemicals that create moods and emotions. So there are lots and lots of similarities and no sharp breaks.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Carl Safina, author of the book Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. What is the evidence for language in animals?
Well, it depends, again, what you mean by language. So let's make a definition. Language is using sounds that mean particular things that have a syntax so that the order of those words makes a difference. A blind Venetian is very different than a Venetian blind, for instance. So let's say that that's what language is. Language is sort of a complicated vocabulary or a fairly extensive vocabulary with syntax. There are lots and lots of animals. In fact, I would say all animals and actually many plants communicate in different ways. They send out chemical signals and receive chemical signals and respond appropriately to those things, even though in the case of plants, they probably are not at all conscious. Those are probably automatic. And other animals have chemical communication, as do we. They have body language communication. They have vocal communication, all these things. What they don't have is much syntax. But dolphins can understand some syntax, so they must be able to use it. Same thing with apes. Certain monkeys have simple syntax. They have calls that may convey the difference between saying, there's a leopard right here, and I see a leopard that's very distant, so just be on alert. Those are the inklings of syntax that you can see in other animals, but humans have certainly developed that the most. And probably that is the thing that most makes humans human, I think, is the extensiveness of our vocabulary and of our use of syntax.
Why have humans tended to believe that other animals are inherently different from ourselves and to dismiss the idea that animals have consciousness?
I think the reason that we do that is because we are very insecure, and it really bothers us to think that we're not extremely special. So we think that we are transcendent and divinely inspired, and many people believe that we are separately created. Those things just speak to our insecurities. They also make it a lot easier for us to do whatever we feel like to other animals without thinking too much about how it affects them.
How does the social structure of family groups in, for example, elephant or wolf populations reflect on animal consciousness?
The more complicated the social structure, the more intelligent animals are. For a long time, people thought that the harder it was to get food, the more intelligent animals would be. But that doesn't seem to be the case. For instance, elephants eat grass. There are a lot of animals that eat grass that are not particularly smart. Elephants are exceptionally smart, and they have very, very complicated social lives. They know hundreds of individuals in dozens of families. They keep track of their family members for decades. They have to remember things like where to go when all the water dries up, where is the remaining water during the worst droughts. They have to remember those things for decades. So the idea of what you need to do to keep yourself and your family companions alive and knowing who your friends and rivals are among your own group or other groups seems to be what makes intelligence happen, if I can put it that way, makes it evolve.
How has poaching by humans affected these animals' social groups?
Well, one distressing thing with this book is that I went to the most energetically protected populations of these three groups that I focused on, elephants and wolves and killer whales. And I thought I was taking a break from writing about conservation, but in each case, even in these very protected populations, I found animals that are up against the lethal force of human beings all the time. People are killing them just by shooting them dead, or in the case of the killer whales, the Navy still practices with live bombs where the so-called endangered orcas of the Pacific Northwest live. Their endangered status doesn't protect them from having bombs dropped near them, near enough to kill them occasionally. Wolves in Yellowstone National Park, the minute they go outside the park, most of them get shot. And the elephants don't even have to go outside the parks to get shot. The poaching is rampant and out of control in Africa right now. And from Roman times, when people from Europe first started to go seeking ivory until now, there's probably 1% of the elephants now numbers than there were then, and they occupy about 10% of the range that they occupied then. It's really the geography of an animal that we are driving to extinction, and it's very distressing to see that.
How does the loss of a leader affect the family group?
When an elephant family loses its leader, a lot of the cohesion falls apart, and they lose a tremendous amount of the memory that will keep them alive during the worst times. Sometimes the family splinters, sometimes it stays together. Often the remaining females don't breed very well for a number of years in a row. The babies don't survive as well because they don't have the leadership that will help them stay alive, which is what the oldest elephants in the family do, the matriarchs. If a matriarch is killed and her eldest daughter is actually quite old, you know, if she's in her 30s, she may be able to take over fairly well. If she's only in her early 20s, a lot of bad things can follow from that. So often the lives of the survivors involve more suffering than the killing of the one that has been shot.
What is the evidence that animals have emotional responses similar to humans?
To me, that evidence is so blinding that it's very perplexing that so many people keep asking that question. I mean, it's very easy to see in our own homes with our own pets, our dogs and cats, when they're happy, when they're distressed, when they're unhappy, when they're fearful. If something frightening happens, it scares them. You know, we just had the 4th of July. One of our dogs is absolutely terrified by fireworks, and he acts scared, when he is frightened. And those are emotions just like us. It's be very hard to believe that a dog that is acting frightened of sharp, loud noises is not frightened in a way that we would experience and understand it. Their brains and their brain chemistry in those regions that produce fright, those extremely old regions, are virtually identical to ours for all practical purposes. And, you know, likewise, when they're relaxed, they're relaxed. And they're not relaxed in dangerous conditions. They're relaxed when everything is safe. So all of that makes perfect sense.
What are some examples of animals showing compassion?
Well, elephants are very notable as far as staying with other elephants that have been injured and keeping them company, sometimes feeding them if they can't eat themselves, lifting them up if they have collapsed, staying with an elephant that has died, visiting the bones of family members that have died and been dead a while. So there are all those kinds of things. There's compassion among primates. There's compassion among dogs at times, and certainly dolphins and whales in helping stricken and ailing individuals, keeping them up near the surface, helping them breathe, that kind of a thing. And also grief, similar kinds of circumstances, or carrying dead babies around. Animals that never carry live babies, like elephants and dolphins, will keep carrying or pushing babies around days after they've died. They don't really want to let go. They understand that they're not normal. They may understand that they're dead, but, you know, their behavior is changed by that death. They're trying to maintain contact, and that's really a lot of what grief is.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Carl Safina, author of the book Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel. Would you speak about the ability of elephants to distinguish among different humans?
Yes, that's so interesting. When researchers have set up speakers and hidden them in the bushes and played conversations from different kinds of humans, from tourists, from farmers who don't bother the elephants, and from herders who walk around with spears and sometimes get into conflict with elephants around water holes, what they find is that the same speakers that are in the same place and smell the same, so that's not the difference, that the elephants can distinguish the spoken languages of these three groups. They hear tourists speaking through the speakers in their recordings, and they don't care. They don't respond. Same thing with the farmers. When they hear the herders, they go on alert, they bunch up, and they run away. They know the difference between the people who are dangerous to them and those that are not. And they react very similarly to clothes that have been worn by people in those three groups that are left in the trails where elephants will encounter them, and when researchers watch them do that. They're not afraid of clothes worn by tourists that smell like tourists. They are afraid of clothes worn by the herders that occasionally harm them.
Well, we know about humans training animals, but you also mentioned that sometimes animals train humans. What are some examples of animals training humans?
Sometimes dolphins have herded prey fish toward the shore and then alerted humans by slapping their tails and things like that, and trained humans that, well, okay, here the fish are, now you can cast your nets, and we will pick up some of the injured fish that are falling out of the nets. And in some cases, they've been doing that for over 100 years. There was a place in Australia, in one particular town, where killer whales drove large whales into a bay where they were kind of trapped there, and then some of the killer whales would come and alert the whalers that would come out in their boats and start harpooning the large whales, and the killer whales would get a share of that and actually even sometimes help the whalers by grabbing onto the harpoon ropes with their teeth to slow down the big whales. So, yeah, that's what I mean by that.
What are some examples of animals practicing deception?
There are a fair number of animals that practice deception. Some monkeys have alarm calls for eagles or leopards or things like that, and occasionally if a monkey wants to get up a tree at some fruit and he's being crowded out, or it's a low-status monkey that isn't being given a turn at the food, he may suddenly scream, "Eagle," and everybody will jump out of the trees and he'll stuff his face. There are a few other animals that do things like that. For instance, one case where a researcher was watching a family of hyenas, one of the hyenas happened to turn and look directly at a leopard that was crouching with a newly killed animal, and it just kept walking past until the whole family went out over a rise, and then that one that had seen it came running back. So it didn't alert its friends, and it didn't want to share, but it knew what it was doing, and you know, it had every intention to come back and get that kill from the leopard and have it all to itself. And there are, you know, quite a few stories along these lines.
How might humans be seen by other animals if other animals analyzed us for consciousness?
Oh boy, that's such a big question. I think perhaps they would be dismayed that we are so capable and powerful in some ways and so blind in others and so very cruel in other ways, wanting to take all the room for ourselves and thinking that we can do anything that we want to other animals without much regard, in many cases, to how they feel about it. But unfortunately, humans have been like that not just to other animals, but to other people as well. And it's not a matter of people say, oh, well, animals can't talk. They can't say that they want to stay alive. Well, they certainly can show us by their actions that they want to stay alive. And there are many people who have shown by their actions and pled with their words to stay alive and been swept away by stronger people anyway. And that's a terrible thing to have on our resume and in our human nature, is that the strong obliterate the weak and then make up lots of excuses for why that was okay.
Are there qualities that humans possess that place them in a different category than other animals?
I don't think that there are any categories humans possess that place us in a different category, but we possess a suite of characteristics at the extremes of what we see in other animals. So other animals show empathy and compassion and grief to a limited extent. We show it to a much larger extent. Other animals can be dangerous and aggressive to a certain extent. We show that to an extreme extent at times as well. We are the most creative and most compassionate of all animals, and we are also by far the most vicious and destructive and violent. We are all of those extremes all at once.
In what ways can humans change their perspective to better understand other animals?
I think the first thing is to understand that all life is on a continuum and all life is related, and we are not categorically better than other species. Their lives and their existence is as valid as human existence, and we need to leave them room. And they were here first, and they enrich our lives as well. And so understanding that all life is related, that we are all really one living family, and that all these species have a need and a claim to continued existence, I think is it. And that's really all I'm saying. It's not that complicated.
In what ways does your book help inform conservation efforts?
I think the book helps inform conservation because instead of just showing what we are losing and what's at stake, I'm trying to also add to the conversation who we are losing and who is at stake and how much their lives matter to them and how much they want to stay alive.
What do you hope your book will accomplish?
I hope it will open more hearts and minds to the fact that we're here with a lot of really splendid company and that we don't really value or honor it in the way that it deserves. So I hope we do, and I hope people not only, you know, honor and respect other species in this way that's very serious, but I hope other people want to go out and meet a lot of these other animals and really enjoy it the way that, you know, I and many people I know really love watching animals and going bird watching and being outdoors or just putting up our bird feeders and things like that, that we enjoy the company of these animals very much, and we consider them to be our neighbors.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
What's the message I'd like to leave the listeners with? That's a good question. I think just if you open your hearts and minds will get a lot fuller. So maybe that's the message.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Carl.
Okay, thank you so much for having me. I really super appreciate it.
You were just listening to Carl Safina, author of the book Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel, published in 2015 by Henry Holt & Company. For more information, check on the web at carlsafina.org. That's CARLSAFINA.org. The Sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, Sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts, along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on Demand, and then Podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening. And be sure to tune in to the Sustainability segment again next week on Listener Powered 90.3 FM and KEXP.org.